Well, what I thought I would do, I thought that I would like to talk about yourself and your background and your origins and this sort of thing, leading in to Gerald's party, and then a little discussion about art and literature and the craft of writing. Well, first of all, just tell me how things have been going this week for you.
You mean here at the Penn and with the book coming out and all that? It's been busy. It's been a lot of fun. I found a conference, a Congress in Entertainment. I've heard a lot of funny lines, probably not intentional. Watched a lot of disingenuous pratfalls. Everybody seems to be acting out a kind of pre-written script. But there have been moments of eloquence, too few perhaps, but there have existed, and moments of felt passion and some decent things said about writing and what it was to be a writer in a world as difficult as the one we live in. So I've enjoyed it, and I've had at the periphery of it all, I've had a terrific time.
It's nice. What are some of the meetings that you have attended?
Well, I've gone to most of the panels. I just got finished introducing a group of writers doing their own reading. In the course of it, I mentioned that this was really what such a conference came to. In the end, writers were, whatever else you might say about them, generally wrote better than they talked. And when they talked, it wasn't the unwisest thing to do to read from your own work. The readings I've enjoyed a lot, and I've enjoyed the kind of at-the-fringe things that have been happening, the readings at noon, the spontaneous readings around town, not to mention all the parties and the gatherings of writers and so on. It's been a kind of party for a few days.
You were born in Iowa.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where?
Charles City, a little town on the Cedar River up in the northeast corner of the state.
And you didn't go to the University of Iowa?
No. My dad was in newspapers. We moved around a lot, moved down to southern Indiana, southern Illinois. And I went to university as an undergraduate in southern Illinois and then Indiana. Ended up in Chicago.
What university?
Southern Illinois first, then transferred to Indiana. Then went
Southern Illinois State?
No, the Carbondale University, SIU.
Oh, that's the one where John Gardner taught.
That's right, yeah, mm-hmm.
They have a nice. They have a very good university press.
They do.
They much better than the average university press.
Certainly,
and a more aggressive one.
Yeah, that's very good. Good library collecting system.
Did you graduate from that college?
No, I transferred over to Indiana my junior year. Graduated from Indiana. Went in the Navy, Korean War days. Came out, took the GI Bill, went to University of Chicago. And that was where I felt I finally got educated after.
That's your MA there.
Yeah.
In, I would assume, English?
No, it was primarily philosophy I was reading. It was a course called General Studies in the Humanities. And you had to combine things, and I combined linguistics, philosophy, and history.
You said that your father was a newspaper man. I would assume that means that you grew up in a relatively literate household.
Well, no. It's a small town newspapers my father was involved in, and not so much on the writing end as the management end of them. I started out very young as a reporter for my dad's paper. I was 14, I was working for them already. So I grew up in an atmosphere of journalism, which is very different from literacy.
Did you say literacy?
That's what I said, yeah.
Congratulations.
And,
I'm sure some of my colleagues wouldn't like that, but I think it's quite apt.
So, in fact, it took me quite a long time to understand what I meant when I was, as I was saying all the time at that age, that I was going to be a writer. I didn't have a very clear sense of what that meant, and for a while I thought it did mean getting a job with, I don't know, Time Magazine, or perhaps it would have been CBS if I'd have got around to something as wonderful as that. And instead, as the years went on, I began to understand more about what it meant to be a writer, what writing could mean. And in particular, following the Navy, when I went back to graduate school, I was by then committed to writing in a wholly different way from that which I'd kind of developed for myself through high school and college. I don't think I mean, I was still discovering in my late 20s people like Cervantes and, you know, Shakespeare virtually, except for a handful of important books. So my important reading occurred starting in the Navy and then following.
So your literary experience then began rather late in your life.
Late, self-taught, somewhat naive. I think this is a problem of people growing up in, I don't know where you're from, but when you grow up in the Midwest, everything looks kind of simple and local, and the big world about publishing and the famous books and so on looks like it takes place somewhere else, beyond the horizon, well beyond the horizon. And so it took me a while to kind of cover some ground. I had to get out of that space, and I had to move, literally, pick myself up and go out of that kind of entrapment of the Midwest, of the big prairie out there. And as I did that and began to accumulate some reading very haphazardly, you know, a book here, a book there, not knowing exactly why I was reading each one thing following another, somebody saying, don't miss that, or somebody referring to a book and another book and so on, picking it up as I went along. And I think the discovery for me that was perhaps one of the most important ones was following on finding writers like Dostoevsky, Kafka, and Lawrence Stern of Tristram Shandy and so on, and Joyce. The discovery that was important was that of Beckett. And it was from Beckett I got sort of the clearest sense of art as vocation, and also the sense of the end of something, that he was putting the final words on the board that was shaped in a certain way, and this work going to be erased, and you had to start something over when you were finished with Beckett. He didn't allow you to go back and write another 19th century novel. You know, times were changing, and he did have that kind of very powerful influence on me at a very critical moment, just as I came out of the Navy, entered into graduate school in Chicago, took a summer off before and went up to Canada, pulled out in a cabin on an isolated lake, and just read and wrote a little and read a lot, and read Beckett side by side with the Bible, you know, from page one to the last page, something I'd wanted to do, and a few other very important reading experiences at that moment.
You spent the entire summer alone in a cabin? And
yeah, well, it wasn't the entire summer, but it was a stretch of time, and it was, yes, I was alone, and just it was with books and typewriter. It was a sort of time to sort things out, what it meant to me to decide that I was going to write. And it was clear to me I did not want to be a professional in the kind of standard sense of that term. And yet I wasn't quite sure what it meant, what it was that I did mean to do. And it was from writers like Beckett that I began to get a perception of that. Art as a vocation, as a commitment, rather than simply, a way to get through the days, a way to make some money, or meet all the girls.
You went back to college to get your master's after that summer. What did you say you, what was the focus of your study?
Well, back at the university, this was in Chicago. Chicago was the first really meaningful experience in an institutional way that I'd had. And I got involved immediately with a philosopher there named Richard McKeon. He taught a sequence of courses on what he called ideas and methods. And it was a kind of effort to understand the entire history of human discourse, seen in terms of certain patterns based on the kind of ineluctable necessities of language itself. And it clarified a lot of my own thinking about language that I'd been struggling with this myself, had kind of clumsy ideas about it, and he helped me perceive the sense of what I was doing and the sense of my approach to language. And just taught me a great deal more, a lot of which I've probably since forgotten, but it was a kind of marvelous sequence of courses taken side by side with courses in art, in history, in various topics to the edge, because his history of discourse did include everything. So one could talk about physics or humanities or sociology equally well in terms of the problems of discourse itself and the uses of language. So that was very, that had a lot of impact. I didn't do a lot of writing in the years that I was at Chicago, though I did some. Mostly it was just catching up. I suddenly realized how inexcusably ignorant I was and how much I had to do. I couldn't pretend to write until I learned an awful lot more. So it was a very intense period of reading and study and writing about other writing. I, of course, did take some literature courses also along the way, but they were not the most important ones to me. They had a certain value, but the important things happening to me were outside literature, as far as Chicago was concerned. So I left Chicago without even going ahead and getting my degree. I was just excited about being around this man as long as I could afford to do that. When the monies ran out that made it possible and I had to go out and take jobs in the world, I managed to kind of skimp along until one day I needed to teach, and then I needed the MA, and then I needed to get my thesis in and take my French exam and so I could apply for jobs.
So you went back to Chicago to get that?
Yeah, yeah.
What year did you get your...
Very briefly, 65.
'65.
Yeah, but I finished up there really in '61.
And what did you do between '61 and '65 then?
Well, several things. I started, my wife's from Spain. She's from Catalonia, from Tarragona. And we traveled a lot as best we could, picking up scholarships, doing whatever we could. And we ended up in Spain, in her hometown. Spent 3 years there. That's when I did The Origin of the Brunists and the first draft of the baseball book. And that's then when I ran out of money. That was 64. And so I pushed to get the degree in 65, and we came home to teach in 66. And then I stayed in the States until I managed to Guggenheim.
Now, Origin of the Brunists was published in 66, but you had actually written it 2 years prior.
Well, yeah, I'd started it in 1960. It takes a long time to finish a book, and I completed it and turned it in 65, a little before, around, I think it was spring of 65, I finally got it finished, and it was brought out a year later. The baseball book first draft was a much shorter project, where Brunus had taken me, I don't know, 4 years or something like that. The baseball book, Universal Baseball Association, J. Henry Wall proprietor, was written in 5 very short weeks in a monastery village in called Santos Creus, near my wife's hometown. A sculptor friend had a flat up there he used on weekends, and he said I could use it from Monday to Friday, and I went up there for 5 straight weeks and ended up with the first draft of that book. It just seemed to write itself so easily. Brought that back with me, taught the following fall semester, had a brief break in the middle, spent 10 days working on a revision, and turned it in. Kind of miracle of speed. After that, public burning took me nearly 7 years, and Gerald's party is about 6. waiting for another one of those miracles to occur.
There is no accounting for it, is there? Just no accounting why one book takes longer than another, and yet reading the two books together, they could have the same amount of skill and the same degree of complexity. And yet one comes easier for the writer than the other.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of areas kind of risk and danger, which sometimes are passed through painlessly. You just got it figured out right away. And other times it doesn't resolve itself so simply. And I think the problems that cropped up in the baseball book did seem to resolve themselves so quickly and in such a relaxed way. And I don't know, something in the voice just allowed me to get through everything. And it's rather short. And it has a very specific kind of form, which limited what I was likely to do. I was restricted in my own mind the way the form was to 7 chapters plus an 8th final one. So there were like an inevitability of these 8 chapters, and they weren't to be too long. So there was only so much that could conceivably happen in that space. The other books tend to be more open-ended, and I wouldn't know when I began quite... how many chapters there were to be. I'd think there would be 1, and then it turns out there would be 7, and then maybe 14 or 21 or 50 or something. And each time that it began, each one of those things began to grow, I tended to try to restructure it in some way, some ironic way, which I hoped would close the doors on my tendency to, you know, explode at all junctures. And that was true of the origin of the Brunists and the public burning, which, not coincidentally, have exactly the same number of chapters. The Gerald's Party, the new book, contrarily, has no chapters, and I had no way to stop it.
I noticed
had,
that.
I had to rely entirely on my characters to do it for me.
Usually what I do is to take my bookmark, and when I come to the end of the chapter, when I'm getting tired, I always try to go to the end of the chapter so that it's everything's compartmentalized. And I kept reading on and on, you know, looking for a place to, you know, I had to go away, have dinner, you know, and I keep putting, looking for a place, and I found that there were no chapters. It's one, well, we're getting really ahead a little bit. I just, before we get up, just so I have some fix on your identity, you also lived in England for a while, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I got a Rockefeller grant in 1969. And we went back to Europe, thinking we would stay, in fact, in my wife's country again, but needing a little bit of library time. I had projects now that required quite a bit of research. So we stopped off in England, and we settled into a rental in a seacoast town on the Channel, a little middle-class kind of fishing town of sorts, even amateur weekend fishing, as well as a little bit of local deep-sea fishing. And it was a very attractive atmosphere. I found I was working exceedingly well in this particular space. So we found a house for sale for £5,000. And lots of land. It was a beautiful old house and sat right on the Channel, views out over to France from our second floor window. So I bought it. I'd never owned anything like that before, and it never occurred to me that it might need all new plumbing and all new electricity and all new roof and new walls and floors, for that matter. But it was, and it was another year really before I got it into shape. But then it became an extraordinarily fruitful working place. And we went, if we had to leave it, like to take a brief teaching thing in the States for one semester to store up a little cash, we'd go do that and come straight back to that house. And we were there for almost 10 years.
How did you, as a Middle Westerner, get on in England?
Well, I think I was exotic enough to them that they were amused by me anyhow, and didn't kind of throw me out of the country. I developed a lot of very, very close friendships in England, not with the kind of establishment people, but with kind of offbeat types, fringe types, many of whom are some of England's most exciting talent, and we. We learned to love the pub life, at least the ritual of it, the kind of quiet 9:30 to 10 o'clock drink before last call, pint always, good English beer. I became a soccer fanatic, and my son was growing up then, playing it up on the village green. We became followers of a team, still are. And so the rhythms were easy. Walks along the seafront, now and then a soccer match, a little bit of BBC. Occasional gathering with friends. I was becoming something of a wine buff and beginning to collect a cellar, so we'd have occasions to get together and test it out. And other than that, I was just writing all the time. I got some help after the Rockefeller. I got a Guggenheim, eventually another. My publisher at that time was Dutton. The real person and I was involved with there was a young editor named Hal Charlotte. Beautiful man. He sent me a little money from time to time whenever I needed it and helped out in that way too, promised everything would get into print, not to worry. That one unfortunately was kind of rudely interrupted when I was in the middle of the public burning back in that house, White Horses as it was called, in Kingsdown near Deal. And feeling I just almost couldn't finish the public burning. I'd been at it so long, and it was so big, and it was so taxing. And the only thing sort of keeping me going was the knowledge that, well, at least Hal would publish it. He promised me. He'd seen what was in it, and he'd still publish it. And then he died suddenly. Had a heart attack heart failure of a kind, playing tennis in his 30s, which was really sad for the whole industry here, because a lot of writers had come to depend on him a great deal. And so I went through a kind of period of trying to relocate myself in industry.
Well, you were left without an editor, and I would assume, well, you had no one to advance your cause at Dutton.
Yeah, I began to run out of money. And so we had to think about giving up our England expatriation and come back. I had children by this time entering university stages, and this was high tuition, and I had to have something more stable than, you know, and a few handouts. So we came back, and I began picking up teaching jobs here and there. We moved to Providence because it was a lot like where we'd been living in England, seaside, easy to jump into some vehicle, in this case usually a plane, and get over to the continent. And the climate's kind of wet and comfortable, and quiet atmosphere, and sort of the same things I was doing in England I could do in Providence. That's been damaged a little bit by the fact that I'm now having to teach, so now there's a little bit more rigor to my life.
But you went to Providence to teach?
No, I went there just to live.
Oh, was that right?
Yeah. Had friends.
That's
there.
An unlikely, well, I can see the comparisons you've made with England, but it's a rather unlikely place to seek out.
Well, people would say that, but actually there are a lot of writers and artists there. It's not expensive, got nice big houses, it's low key, but still there's something. We've got a good theater, we've got a good, you know, one of each, one good Japanese restaurant, et cetera. We're about an hour away from Boston, and about three from New York. It's a little like when we lived between London and Paris when we were living on the coast in England. And
when did you start teaching at Brown?
Well, I started teaching elsewhere, and then the people at Brown felt that if I was going to live there and if I was going to have favors like using the library and so on, and besides, if I was going to keep their friendship, I should teach at Brown. So we began slowly, and it slowly picked up until now I'm kind of full-time and contracted, at least through the period of time that my children need tuition help.
At Brown? Are they going to Brown?
No. No, I wouldn't have encouraged it even just because I think college is a time to go away from home, not to stick around the family.
Are you teaching? What are you teaching at Brown?
I have a graduate writing workshop every semester that I teach. And a senior seminar for undergraduates of some literary or quasi-literary sort. Sometimes it's partly writing as well. Lately I've been teaching a course called Exemplary Ancient Fictions, which is...
Beowulf.
Well, yes, it includes Beowulf, but no, it goes back. We do creation myths and the Bible and fairy tales and a bit of Ovid and some medieval romances and... Arabian Nights and jokes and various forms that existed before Don Quixote, in other words, before the convention of the novel. And at the same time, we read contemporary so-called avant-garde writing, writers like Calvino or Angela Carter or Stanley Elkin or Hawkes or Barth and so on. And try to understand, try to discover if there's a relationship between these writings. And the general feeling one gets is that, in fact, what was called innovative is, in a sense, an effort to recover the mainstream, or that part of the mainstream that was abandoned when we moved into the convention of the novel. So we read old material, very new material, we criticize it, and then we try to write from within it, too, and tell tales of a sort, like dream stories and transformations and folk tales for a contemporary adult audience.
Well, the public burning did eventually find a home at the Viking. That was in 1977. So it has been almost 10 years since you have put forth another novel. Why so long?
Well, part of it was the moving about when we decided that we couldn't hold out in England and had to think about what we were going to do next. We tried moving into London first and then gave that up and came on home. And there was a certain amount of time just spent in getting new homes ready and getting old homes done away with and getting children into university or into school still, which was the case when we first came back. And at the same time, and doing some teaching, which I hadn't been doing before, it slowed me down. At the same time, I was doing a lot of writing, which wasn't only in Gerald's Party. I published in this interim two or three novellas, and I have two books coming out almost in tandem following this one. Within a year, we'll have a collection of short fictions, all new ones, called A Night at the Movies.
This year or the year following?
I think it's going to be next January, 87. And then I've revised, enlarged somewhat, an old novella, not that old, but a novella from the 70s, called Whatever Happened to Gloomy Gus of the Chicago Bears. And that story will appear, the date of the story...
Has that been published?
No, that will follow in tandem upon the stories. So I mean to say there's a lot coming along.
No, but that has not been published, the one that you have revised.
No.
Okay.
Oh, you mean has the unrevised version been published?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was published in American Review, Ted Solotaroff's magazine.
But not as a separate book?
No. It actually is coming out, I should say, in April, in French translation, as a book, prior to English translation.
Well, this brings us up... today pretty well. The public burning, now, that was an overtly, you may hate this description, right? I saw it, or see it as an overtly socio-political satire. Yeah, but I am not sure how to describe Gerald's Party.
An overtly socio-political satire.
No, it's not. Maybe you can give me some help. I was trying to come up with a code word that would sum it up in 10 seconds, but I found it not possible for me to do it. So can you tell me how you see Gerald's Party and the thrust, or the type of a novel that it is?
Well, I can only kind of go to its origins because I don't want to talk about it from the outside in. But at its root, I began it as a story. Like most of my things have begun, Public Burning began as a story. I don't begin by thinking I'm going to have another book to bring out. I just begin by having a metaphor, a little something that has to be opened up and looked at. And if it's 2 pages or 10 or 20, I don't know when I begin, but I usually tend to hope that it's just going to be short. I'd like to get it done with. And then some begin to get bigger and bigger. This one began sort of as a reaction, not exactly a protest, but a kind of irritable reaction against a certain kind of popular novel about bourgeois intellectuals at parties. This kind of ritual gathering of these upper middle class types for a little fun and games with one another. And that was the kind of opening feeling about it, that I wanted to just play with that idea a moment. It was conjoined with a desire to do a piece that was theatrical. I had several theatrical ideas in mind. One of them was from those old days when I was following my dad around as a newspaperman, and whenever I'd get sick at home, a lot of you maybe have done this yourself, would do a family newspaper, and I'd write up the family news and make the columns and put the headlines and so on, and I'd also do cartoons. And one of the cartoons I liked to do was a cartoon about actors playing parts, which were what you would read. And I had a little stable of actors, and I would put mustaches on them or wigs or what have you, and they could play different roles. It could be old or young and so on in the different little dramas I would do then in the comic strips. And I wanted that idea of having actors behind the characters. There's a psychological reality to this, but that wasn't the main concern. I just wanted to play with that idea. And as I started from that distance, the other elements of theater began to come into play. I'd worked with the Nixon mentality and the public burning. I liked the way that people felt drawn into him and felt a sympathy with this portrait of him, in spite of what they knew him to be and in spite of what he does and what happens to him in the book. And I thought, well, it's easy to keep your ironic distance if you know his name is Richard Nixon, but if you don't know his name, if his name is something simple like Gerald, it might be you. How do you achieve that distance from him? I mean, how do you escape from being sucked into this consciousness? And so I played with that idea and set his consciousness as a kind of stage. And that stage is dominated by what he perceives as his self or his ego, which a friend later tells him doesn't exist. And it's invaded or assaulted by all the guests at his party whose main task at all times is to get center stage, mainly to the center of Gerald's consciousness. And they try all sorts of things to accomplish this. So the feeling of dealing with actors in this atmosphere and the idea of having this kind of a party. And I wanted to say that something was over, something was finished, and this led me to the metaphor of murder. And since I had this theatrical concept, it was easy for her to be an actress, the victim. And that's about what I knew when I began. I didn't know it was going to be a murder mystery. There's a moment very early in the book when the body's been discovered and everybody's quite upset about it, and Gerald is shaken. He's been pursuing this girl around whom he's going to continue to pursue all night. And he goes to see his wife in the kitchen and to tell her that Roz has been murdered. And she has already got the news, but she's continuing to lay out the bologna and whatever to be taken out to the dining room. And he's sort of at a loss, and he says, well, what do we do next? And she said, well, I think we should call the police. And until she said that, I didn't know that that's right. That's, of course, what we ought to do next. And sure enough, here they come, and in walks Inspector Pardue and his two cops, Bob and Fred, who in many ways take over the book. So what it was as it began and what it was kind of slowly shaping itself into are two similar but different things.
There are all sorts of little things in Gerald's party that are interesting to me, that communicate well in ways that I could never communicate. For example, I think Raj is going crazy, running around the room, and one of Pardue's officers grabs him, and I remember the image in the book. He finally, I can't remember if he put handcuffs, or he grabs Raj, holds him down, then he looks over at Gerald and puffs out his cheeks and blows and shakes his head, rolls his eyes or something like that. Now, I've seen this gesture, this mannerism in people who have suddenly confronted an irksome physical task and then have turned to someone else with that same sort of gesture to share, in order to get empathy, to share, look what I've just been through. And, I mean, that's such an interesting touch. That's one of many. I mean, there are a lot of them like that, that you don't think about, I guess. I mean, you know, I think the reader is not particularly analytical. I mean, the reader just reads. But these ideas cut through. I mean, they register in the subconscious, in any event. You have so many actors. How did you keep track of all of these people running? And I could see Gerald's house as a stage. I mean, all these people are coming in and running out, going from one room to another, up the stairs, down the stairs, and so forth. How did you keep track of all these people? Did you make a big chart on the wall, or did you just burn them into your memory?
Well, I you can't avoid in any work of writing that you do and having kind of backup materials like charts, like that's all those kind of mnemonic devices. But since I had set for them, their task was to constantly crash his consciousness, to make their way there to center stage. It was necessary that I found myself going down the list and said, who haven't I heard from? Who's not made a noise lately? And in that sense, yes, I kind of kept track of them by lists. But obviously, this is kind of a commonplace, but they obviously had a lot of resonance in my own head. I mean, I kept them constantly in front of me, and they were acting out this stuff. And a lot of times they banged their way in without my being able to stop it. Sometimes I wished they wouldn't, but there they came, you know, making noises and telling wisecracks and so on, even even when I would wish they had gone away.
How did you happen to adopt this stylistic mode in that has created a single chapter for Gerald's Party?
Well, it's a turning on of consciousness. This is the stage. There's no way to kind of switch it off.
Well, you talked about the theatrical elements, but even most plays have three acts.
Yeah, but not when you're dealing with consciousness. That is, either Gerald's asleep or he's awake. And if he's asleep, there's still a kind of subconscious consciousness going on. There is sort of no opportunity once the idea is set in motion of this perceiving eye, until that perceiving eye says, I'm going to stop perceiving. And his last act is to switch off the TV, as it were, at the end. No, now click. And there's a kind of drone line. There's several drone lines. I got up the idea of having all these people try their hand at certain simple lines, as though they were auditioning, right? So you have lines that they all have a go at. And one of those was not yet. So they all get a chance at this one. Almost everybody in the book gets that line once. And when Gerald switches the notes, it ends that kind of drone tone of not yet. But incidentally, and more indirectly to answer your question, I guess, I mentioned this began as a kind of story. And what really began to happen was it became a kind of summation in lots of ways of all the stories in Prick Songs and Descants. That was the collected book of stories that came out between the baseball book and Public Burning. And so in a way, it's like the most complicated, the longest, most dense.
Dense,
short story.
Dense.
Short story ever told. I mean, that's kind of what I guess it was.
Well, but your writing takes storytelling a step further. It's also, it seems to me as though you're playing a game with the reader. I mean this in a positive sense, a game with the reader and a game with yourself. Because you can pick up a Zane Grey, pick up an Agatha Christie, and you can see a story. And it starts and it ends there. Obviously, with Gerald's Party and the Public Burning as well, you certainly take the story a step further.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on that?
Well, yes. My feeling in this particular instance, since I was playing with the ideas I've already described, it was important not to have a story that, in the conventional sense, started and ended. This would have been, in terms of a convention, of the recent past, of the kind of novelized convention of the last century. And I didn't, since that was in a way what was under assault here, I had to be careful not to do it exactly the same way. I had to ironize that whole activity of the pretending that the events, the kind of explosion of events in human life, can in fact be reduced so simply to a story that, quote, makes sense.
Well, I certainly see your work as being in the mold of writers like Bartholomew and William Gass and John Barth. These are writers who use words and images in a very unconventional style. Barth's last novel, which I don't know if you read it, was called Sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a chance to read that?
Yeah, sure.
If you had, well, you know, he had done something that I had never thought before could be done, but he did it. He has two people narrating the same story, and they don't just switch off either. I mean, it's impossible. You say you have a dual narrator, two people telling the same story simultaneously. You say, well, you can't do it. There's no way you can write that. But I guess that shows, and some of the things that you have done really shows that there is almost no limit to what one's imagination can create. Literarily.
Well, that's unfortunately it's not exactly true. One would hope that it were limitless. It's certainly incredibly varied, and it's a much richer the possibilities than those that have been explored so far. So the feeling I think a lot of us had right after World War II, when we began our earliest writing, and more significantly through the 1960s, when we were all sort of coming of age in our writing. When I say all of us, I mean these people you've been talking about, a lot of other American writers as well, but also a lot of Latin American writers. That was the era of the boom in Latin American fiction. The Nouveau Roman writers in France, writers like Günter Grass. There was a kind of worldwide... met this pen conference, Kobo Abe from Japan, who was another Italo Calvino, who just recently died. There's a range of this kind of writing that seemed to occur almost spontaneously, as though something were in the air. And that feeling had to do with the restrictions, the unnecessary restrictions of the novelistic conventions. They seemed to be being held in place by a conservative notion of how the world worked that wasn't even quite true anymore. It seemed to be Newtonian, you might say, as opposed to Einsteinian. It did not contain the current realities. If form in any way, structure of a novel in any way, reflects the structure of the societies in which it's made, the societies we saw developing did not seem to be, quote, novelistic societies. And so some route had to be found to recover some way of describing and structuring our stories so as to reflect this new reality. And typically, a lot of us just went back to forms that had been abandoned to see what they might offer to us. And it was, and still is, quite playful, quite experimental, not in the sense of trying to invent something new, experimental sense of trying things which may be old, but trying them again in new ways, and the experimental part of it being, well, does it work or doesn't it? That is, it's experimental in the sense that a lot of it, in truth, doesn't work. You try it, it's okay, but it's not great. So there's been a lot of playful attitudes toward form, toward the way a story can be told, to parodies and ironizations of the way stories have been told in the past, and this has been a kind of worldwide event, at least Western worldwide event.
Well, do you read, does reading some of the other writers who take this playful approach, does that throw you off at all in terms of your own work?
No, I don't know what it does anymore. I'm not sure that it has the same effect it had originally. When I first was writing, I felt I was doing this all by myself. And there was a kind of uncertainty about, you know, does this make sense? I like it, but am I doing something that makes sense to anybody else? And you show it to a few people and say, my God, it's crazy. You know, I don't understand a thing that's happening. And I had the feeling often that, you know, that I might just be eccentric in my approach to writing. But even so, was discovering a lot of writers who had preceded me, at least preceded me as a writer in the late 50s, early 60s. And these included people like Samuel Beckett, and whom I'd mentioned, and Bill Kafka and Joyce and so forth. So it wasn't like there wasn't some support. And then began to discover writers appearing all around me. Early on, I was reading Borges and Asturias with his very wonderful Señor Presidente, work of what he called himself magic realism. And plus the Nouveau Roman people, Roch Grier and Claude Simon and Robert Pinget. And then discovering colleagues, people more or less my age, doing things that were perhaps different from what I was doing, but certainly much more like what I was doing than what the conventional novels were.
The problem is, those of you who write unconventional novels... find themselves with a select audience. I remember taking a much admired relative of mine to Broadway, where we saw Joel Grey in George M., story of George M. Cohen. And as we walked out of the theater, my esteemed relative said, "It was wonderful. I sat there the whole evening and I didn't have to think." Mm-hmm. So if you write a book that taxes the reader's mind, this is certainly good and challenging, and no question about that, but I don't know how many people want to have their minds challenged,
well,
whether they read or watch television or go to the movies.
Actually, lots of them. fact, more close to an infinite number there than we could talk about infinite exercises of the imagination. But they don't all live in my time. I think of, you know, readership in this case is both vertical and horizontal. In a vertical sense, through time, there have been a lot of readers of Moby Dick. In Melville's time, there weren't any. Joyce, I think, published, 40 copies or something of the Dubliners first time round, bought 30 of them himself, probably. Even in his own lifetime, didn't see really gigantic sales of Ulysses, or I think of that book especially, but also Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Finnegan's Wake. And now, of course, it not only sells thousands of copies a year, but there's a whole industry built around Joyce. I mean, there are many men and women in this country or in other countries earning their livings, dedicating their entire lives to this guy. And I don't think it would have done him any good to worry about how many people were going to read the book when it came out.
Well, it's obvious from the way you talk, you want to have a place in literary history for your work, whether you're around to enjoy it or not, but you want these books to be read on. But the problem with that is that books are, by their very nature, ephemeral. And books have a tendency. That's why there are rare book dealers who sell books, and including some of your early books of your own. The Brunus book is an expensive book if one goes to a rare book, because I go to rare book shows. I love to be around books, and so I go. I can see the prices of these books. And you're talking about a recent book, you know, 1966.
Yeah.
So the reason that there are so few of these books around is that people treat them as ephemera. They will pick up a book and they'll read it, and they will pass it on to their aunt and their uncles, and the book gets torn up, and eventually it winds up in the Salvation Army, and they begin to vanish.
You're describing all life. That, so we all end up in the Salvation Army one way or the other.
That is true. But when we're talking about a person's niche in history in terms of literature, you have to hope that not all these books will vanish, so that people will have the chance to read them in the future.
Yeah, I don't really, I guess, really want it or hope for it. It doesn't really matter. I'm going to be dead. I'm not going to enjoy that as a pleasure. I think what I feel that once I made that commitment to writing as a vocation, I have to explore it intransigently, the potential of it, and to understand what my kind of responsibilities are to it and to other things in the world as a consequence of it. And just doing that's enough for me. Just being where I know I am at the leading edge. I can feel it, I know what's important, and I'm fulfilling that responsibility myself to be doing that. I'm not concerned about, you know, the luck of the draw. It may be that we'll have a tidal wave hit New York, or you know, worse, the whole Penn Conference has been under the dark cloud of atomic apocalypse the whole week. And there are a lot of ways one could imagine that these books can disappear, completely erased from the memory of man, even. That isn't significant to me. What I like is just being where I am. I know that this is a good place to be in terms of fiction, and I just enjoy doing that. And it doesn't worry me about a vast number of readers. I know that the readers who are concerned about the things the way I am are reading the books, and that's enough for me.
Robert Coover, I think we talked longer than 30 minutes, and we could probably talk about books and writing and whatever for the next few hours, but I know you probably have a party.
How did you know?
That you can't miss, and they're probably already running out of wine, so I better let you go. I thank you very much for coming in. It's a real treat. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. And